The headlines this hour: Russia says the U.S. must withdraw its nuclear weapons from non-nuclear countries and eliminate the infrastructure for their deployment in Europe. Pakistan's Supreme Court resumes hearing on the dismissal of a no-confidence vote against Prime Minister Imran Khan and the dissolution of Parliament. And a new survey finds that suffering has reached unprecedented levels in Afghanistan, with almost the entire nation experiencing dire conditions. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Russia is critical of the U.S. deploying atomic weapons in non-nuclear NATO states, insisting that they must be eliminated from Europe. The Deputy UN Representative, Dmitry Polyansky, says Washington is violating the Non-Proliferation Treaty. He says U.S. non-strategic atomic weapons are kept in non-nuclear European countries, adding such weapons and their delivery means are even being modernized. Speaking at a meeting of the UN Disarmament Commission, Polyansky also criticized the involvement of NATO's non-nuclear members in nuclear weapons training under joint missions. He rejected the idea of Russia using nukes in the Ukraine conflict, saying that Moscow would only use its nuclear potential in response to similar attacks against Russia or its allies. Russia and the U.S. possess around 90% of the world's atomic weapons. We've talked to historian and author Marcus Papadopoulos. Here is his take on why Americans continue to have nuclear weapons in Europe.
It is my submission that the reason why the Americans continue to have nuclear weapons in Europe is to ensure that America remains politically, economically, and militarily in Europe, and that Europe continues to remain in the stranglehold of Washington's. Indeed, we can say the same about NATO. The very reason that NATO was established in the first place was to keep the Americans in Europe, the Germans down in Europe, and the Russians out of Europe. Despite how destabilizing American nuclear weapons are in Europe, the Americans nonetheless will continue to keep them there because, as I said moments ago, it is a way of preserving American influence and power in Europe.
It's day 41 of the Russian military offensive against Ukraine, and here is a quick rundown of the theater of war. The White House claims that Russia is shoring up its campaign in eastern Ukraine with probable plans to deploy tens of thousands of soldiers there. The U.S. says Russian forces are pulling away from Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, in a shift towards the eastern regions. Ukrainian officials also say that Russia is preparing for a big attack in the east and have urged mass evacuations there. Moscow says its drawdown near Kyiv and the northern city of Chernihiv is a goodwill gesture to support peace talks. Ukraine and its allies say that Russia was forced to shift its focus to eastern Ukraine after suffering heavy losses near Kyiv. In the south, heavy fighting reportedly continues around the besieged city of Mariupol as Russian forces try to take the city. The International Committee of the Red Cross says its team has not been able to reach Mariupol to evacuate civilians due to security concerns or conditions. That was the fourth attempt in as many days to reach the city. Diplomatic fallout over the newly discovered mass graves in Ukraine is deepening, with several European countries moving to ban Russian diplomats. Denmark says it will expel 15 diplomatic staff over what the country's foreign minister called apparent war crimes in Ukraine's Bucha. Italy also says it has expelled 30 Russian diplomats on security grounds. Earlier, France, Germany, and Lithuania announced similar measures. All of them have cited the alleged massacre of civilians in Bucha. Russia, on the other hand, is denying reports of killing civilians in northern Ukraine. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is calling the Western accusations false. The Foreign Ministry has also warned that it will retaliate against the expulsion of its diplomats. Political commentator Scott Bennett says the Western countries' accusation that Russia has committed war crimes in Ukraine is in line with their attempts to create a propaganda campaign against Moscow.
They're interested in psychological warfare and propaganda. That's why the British have held up any inquiry into this incident at the United Nations Security Council, most likely because the British know that they'll be found out to having been involved. The British were instrumental in the White Helmet theatrical operations in Syria, where they would pretend that individuals were wounded or killed, and they were found to be crisis actors. So the British are very well aware that they are most likely going to be exposed as creating this propaganda. They've already been exposed as having Polish film crews hiring actors to pretend that there's all sorts of chaos. And of course, the United States is desperate to try and provoke some sort of international outrage against Russia. So it is no doubt that this is completely fabricated, dramatic, and it fits the perfect model that NATO has always pursued. They did this in Libya as well, when they invented a city in Qatar and pretended that it was Tripoli, and did filming of operations there, pretending it was in Libya when it was not. They've also filmed fake beheadings in studios with cameras and studio lights, pretending that it was done in the desert in Libya when it was not.
Pakistan's Supreme Court resumes its deliberations on whether Prime Minister Imran Khan's decision to dissolve Parliament to avert a no-confidence vote was legal. Khan lost his parliamentary majority last week, facing a no-confidence motion. Speculations of the Prime Minister losing the vote had been running rife, but the Deputy Speaker blocked the debate on the motion on Sunday, triggering a full-blown political drama. The crisis deepened after Khan asked the presidency to dissolve the National Assembly and called a snap election. The United Opposition is calling that decision unconstitutional. Khan's cabinet has been dissolved, as well as in anticipation of fresh elections. Prime Minister is accused of failing to revive the economy and cracking down on corruption, but Khan blames foreign conspiracy and says that opposition figures have colluded with the U.S. to topple him. Washington says it has nothing to do with the current turmoil in Pakistan. It's time now for the News Review Edis Bulletin. Suffering at its peak in Afghanistan, a new study shows that almost all Afghan people consider their living conditions to be so dismal to characterize as suffering. According to the Gallup survey, 94% of Afghans have rated their lives poorly enough to be considered suffering. This is the highest level measured for any country since 2005. The study shows that the percentage of women suffering is higher than men, and that women are more pessimistic about their futures. With the entire world now focusing on the conflict in Ukraine, Afghanistan has been deprived of the attention and the humanitarian assistance that it much deserves. The situation has become even worse since the Taliban takeover last year, with the world refusing to recognize the Taliban government and the U.S. freezing billions of dollars worth of Afghan assets. Humanitarian aid to the country has almost entirely dried up. John Stepling is an author and commentator joining us from Inderøy, Norway, and we also have Fra Hughes, who's a writer, activist, and journalist joining us from Belfast. Okay, welcome to you both. John Stepling, let me first start with you. We are very familiar with why Afghanistan is in the state that it is in, but given the fact that you have the dire humanitarian situation worsening in that with that kind of numbers, what can be done in order for them to see some kind of reprieve? Of course, one of the immediate accessibilities that have been denied to the Afghans have been their frozen funds by the U.S.
Right. Well, I mean, all of this of the United States and U.S. imperialism. U.S. occupied Afghanistan for 20 years, and there was never really any reason to place. But this is the pattern, and the media, which is Western controlled, a hegemony on mainstream, it's absolutely Western propaganda almost 100% of the time. There's a crisis, and million people face famine, something like 15 to 20 million in Ethiopia because of civil wars and mended by the U.S. and armed by the U.S. We're seeing the crisis in result of U.S. support and direct in the destruction of that country. Afghanistan, this goes back to Syria, where the U.S., you know, created a narrative that demonized Assad. We saw it with Gaddafi, who was eventually murdered. All the way back, I mean, you can probably trace this in a certain sense. The whole problem, if you want to understand it, ideologically, American sense, that was a sort of offshoot of another think tank, William Crystal and Ben Kagan's, Robert Kagan and his brother Fred, and their Robert Kagan's married to Victoria Nuland, who was the architect of the Crane. They wrote a paper in rather right before 2001 that for the projection of U.S. throughout the world, a neo-colonial paper that was embraced by the Bush administration. A lot of the people involved and so forth were in the Bush administration, Dick Cheney. And that has been the pattern since 2001, has been this escalation of U.S.-NATO aggression, provocation of conflict, which would Ukraine, NATO expansion. There's no reason for NATO to even exist, of course. And Afghanistan has paid. Now you have these millions,
right,
that are completely absent, invisible in Western media. Right now with refugees in Ukraine, and that's getting all the attention. So nobody cares. It's as they don't care about Yemen or Congo or Ethiopia or anywhere else. Palestine. Right.
Sure. Let's take a look, listen to some of the social media posts on this, and we'll get right back to our guest, Farah Hughes, on this. First post, people in Afghanistan are resorting to selling their kidneys on the black market to feed their families as the country faces extreme poverty. The UN estimates that for 24 million people in Afghanistan, more than half of the population, are in need of life-saving humanitarian aid. Next post, lots of noise, but no one understands. There's no money to pay teachers, no resources. Afghanistan is suffering from poverty thanks to the U.S. and European occupation and corruption for the last 20 years, and the looting of all Afghan money. Why don't you talk about this? And a final tweet, over 13,000 newborns have died in Afghanistan since January. Hunger and poverty are forcing people to sell kids. Yet the Taliban's priority is keeping girls out of school. It's clear what they are. The West bombed the country and made them suffer decades of conflict for change, yet. All right, some of the social media posts there. So, Farah Hughes, we could talk about the humanitarian aspect of this situation, which is so dire that words fail to really describe how desperate Afghans are. Of course, its neighbor Iran is doing its best to accommodate some of the people that are either displaced or refugees or what have you. But usually this type of environment is a breeding ground for extremism, and that is what danger lies in the situation, where you're going to find people who are obviously have lost their will to live to perhaps subscribe to some of the groups out there, such as Al-Qaeda or Daesh, as we call them. Shouldn't there then be sufficient and appropriate concern to be channeled to Afghanistan?
Yes, absolutely. When you consider that you've had several decades of war upon Afghanistan, you've had a foreign military, NATO, US, British occupation. You've had the economy, I would imagine, for all that time, driven in the service of the occupation. So you had Afghan men joining the army, not because they believed in supporting a foreign military occupation with a foreign installed puppet regime government, but people needed work, people needed to earn money to provide for their families. So a lot of the economy, I would imagine, in Afghanistan over these several decades has been focused on servicing security needs and security interests and security personnel, UN, NGOs, jobs associated with foreign financial aid that was brought into Afghanistan. A lot of those jobs have now gone because regardless of the kind of religious, political ideology of the Taliban, I personally feel they fought a national war of liberation against a foreign occupying force. The result of that is the economy's in free fall. Is it $9 billion that has been frozen? Those assets belong to the Afghan people. So at a very minimum, those monies should be released by foreign Western banks, governments, and institutions to immediately alleviate the causes of the food scarcity, food shortages, and the, you know, the deaths that are unnecessary, that are occurring every day. And yes, as a byproduct of poverty, as a byproduct of lack of education, people can be drawn into very fundamentalist ideological groupings because they seem to offer an answer. They say, potentially, you know, Afghanistan is in the state it's in because of Western interference in the internal politics and economy of Afghanistan, which is perfectly true. So people who are looking around, who want to blame someone for the circumstances they are in, could very easily blame the West, and I would totally understand why people would do that. And it's a short step from saying America, Britain, and EU are responsible for the unnecessary deaths occurring every day in Afghanistan, that people may be drawing into groupings that say, well, if they're going to do this to us, why don't we give them some payback? So there is a danger there, but that danger could be very easily averted if the West, which has no intention of helping Afghanistan, they're talking about giving like $330 million aid from Britain, $220 million of aid from Germany, $200 million from America. This is a drop in the water, a drop in the ocean for a country that needs over $4.4 billion in the coming year just in order to prevent mass deaths through the famine and to also stop leakage, because every time there's a famine and every time there's a war, you will create a huge refugee diaspora, and those people who are already in Iran will be joined by more people facing starvation and more people going to Pakistan.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Farah Hughes, writer, activist, and journalist. John Stepling, thank you. Author and commentator from Inderøy, Norway. With that, we come to an end for this news review. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
There's a massive problem of homelessness in the UK, and it seems to be getting worse during the COVID-19 pandemic. There's also an ethnic bias in the statistics, with black households more likely to suffer the issues of homelessness than the white population. How can this be happening in a country with considerable wealth and one of the six largest economies in the world? One striking contrast is the difference in the life of the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who has all the advantages of personal wealth and an apartment in Downing Street, while every night many sleep rough within sight of the street where he lives, but a million miles from how he lives. It's a situation that has been brought to prominence by the current pandemic, as key issues associated with homelessness have been left unresolved, while the government struggles with a host of problems in relation to the rapid spread of the disease through the general population. COVID's impact has left a mark on the most vulnerable in terms of housing and homelessness. In most difficulty, those in emergency accommodation plus the large community of rough sleepers carry on trying to cope in temporary accommodation or in the streets of London and beyond. They represent a large group of residents of a country hit by an accommodation epidemic, as the government seems unable to fix one of the biggest and most pressing problems facing hundreds of thousands of men, women and children in Britain.
How does the public feel about a Prime Minister living in luxury while many face accommodation problems or sleep rough not far from his Whitehall residence? And what do thousands living in the streets of Britain's capital city tell us about the state of the nation and its future prospects? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. How do those in the capital feel about the homeless situation in the UK? That's what we asked people here in East London. This is what they told us.
It's very, very tough. Either they put the rent very high, the private landlord, they got the rent is higher. Number two, the homeless, too many. In Tower Hamlet, too many drugs, too many things going on, too many. Even the mayor of Tower Hamlet, he don't care. We have complained to our councillors and the members. They don't bother anything. They don't care about these things.
Of course, no one likes to stay in the outside of homes in the streets, but the conditions and the life is pushed towards people to that way.
I don't know. This is just an opinion. I think it's probably on the rise. I think there's a lot of issues that need to be addressed. Yeah.
You don't have the place to sleep in. You're sleeping outside. So it's very terrible.
Well, I'm not very happy about it. I think they should have more help rather than seeing them sleeping in the street in a big city like London. I don't think it should happen. That's my thing about it, really.
Honestly, I feel like it's a bit dumb that people ain't helping the homeless to get better shelter, if you get what I mean.
I think it seems like a big problem. I mean, when you're walking the streets of London, you can see that there are a lot of people who are sleeping outdoors and they're looking for a place to stay, and particularly over Christmas when the winter months are really, really cold.
I think the homeless crisis that we have in the UK is just rising. So if you look at Australia, India, even America, it's just rising. And we've got to make a difference in the UK ourselves.
They have to sleep outside, and it's not good for us and for the community, for the state.
You know, everywhere I go, majority of the time, I see people, you know, and obviously it's terrible, especially this time of year, you know what I mean? Everyone's cold and people are looking for shelter and stuff like that.
Well, I've got a friend that's homeless, and I met a couple people. Well, they tell me their story, how people treat them, whereas they're not treated right. There's a lot of prejudice going on. You know, it's sad, to be honest. Like, I've even helped homeless people create a home, like build
So, yeah, it's not great, and especially with COVID going on, it's getting worse for them as well, but I don't know, I'm not sure exactly what the solution is.
Oh, it's devastating. It's very prevalent.
I think it's really appalling, really. I think it's, that, you know, 2021, we've got this going on, and I think we should do something about it.
The Prince Philip should, and the Prime Minister should, build good housing for them, like mud, give them a special tree, because they're homeless. Instead of normal houses, they build for people made of sand and stones.
How do you feel about the fact there's so much homelessness in Britain? Because there is a lot. 200,000 people, in fact.
Yeah, it's a really big figure, and it's really alarming for the UK citizens, yeah, definitely.
Especially in UK, it's quite disappointing to see people are still rough sleeping, and especially in this poor weather and during pandemic, it's difficult.
Just for people, it's too expensive. The, you know, the rent prices and stuff.
There's so many of them. I've lived in Britain since 1989. I have never seen that many homeless people ever in my life before.
What do you think about the fact there's so much homelessness in Britain now?
Well, because I think the inequality is, I mean, you know, increasing. So social system is breaking down, and that's why the homelessness is there.
As Boris Johnson lives comfortably in his Downing Street apartment, others live rough in the streets of the capital. How does the public feel about that?
He's the Prime Minister of UK. So he have to live in a security place. He can't live just like us ordinary people.
If Prime Minister lives in a warm place, he must ensure that people which he rules, they should stay in the warm houses, at least in Christmas, I think.
Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, I think he doesn't give a toss about what's happening on the streets, to be honest.
So I don't think it's fair for him to have a certain rule for himself, and the rest, we have the rules of seeing people sleeping outside, you know. I mean, I'm not a rich man, but if I had more space, I'll invite somebody in my house to for the night.
Honestly, I don't think he really cares about homeless people. Like, he only cares for himself, if he's, you know what I'm saying, like, apparently he's been partying along around the coronavirus time, so I don't think he's a great Prime Minister for us to actually do it.
I think he's looking at the national security, he's got other issues on his mind. Now I think with the homeless is that, just like we do a petition for everything, why don't we do a petition for the homeless?
He don't bother anybody. He's a joker. A real joker. Real comedian. Yeah, our minister is a real comedian.
To be honest, I don't think Boris has done enough for a lot of things. I think in his mind, the homeless crisis is probably bottom of his list.
No, he hasn't, but at the same time, he's got way more on his plate as well. Yes, it's always been an issue, and homelessness is something that's an issue everywhere in the world, not just in London and England.
I don't feel as though he's addressed the issue in an adequate way whatsoever. Sadly, though, I feel as his policies are part of a larger conservative agenda to minimise spending and focus on finance in London, which is a shame. But I don't feel like he's kind of a puppet of the Conservative Party, so it's not essentially his problem. It's more of an issue with the changing dynamic of politics within Britain.
Oh, we need to change all of our behaviour, thinking and attitudes as well. It's not for only Boris Johnson, it's also the people thinking. We need to change this one.
This is really disgusting that some people are too wealthy and other people have nothing to sleep.
Boris Johnson is Boris Johnson, isn't it? He can afford it. That's his job.
I don't know how the people like him or me can sleep in peace while the other people are sleeping rough.
It's hard for me to say, really. I think in terms of the amount of money that's going towards the scheme and in terms of helping other homeless people, it's more money definitely could go into places that need it most, you know, to deprived areas, which can be across all of England.
Why has homelessness gone up so much in the UK? And has COVID had an impact?
I think last 2 years, maybe a pandemic has affected this because, you know, most of the people became unemployed. But I think the main reason here is there is a strict you know, common rules in here, and community don't want to accept someone who not belongs to their, you know, who not familiar with them.
Well, I think there's different reasons. First of all, like, there's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of the Brexit has had a massive impact on like people applying for benefits and so on, and then also I think the refugees is another one, and
maybe people are not giving it more thought, you know. And I'm not saying to demonstrate about it, but just to make your opinions known and your feeling, you know, positive action and non-violence. That's it.
The lockdown, which has now taken away people's jobs, so they can't actually get a job, or something else that has happened in their family.
Because there are more people who are struggling to find a job, they're struggling to earn money, and that there's not enough places for them to live.
I think that's because of the government spending is going towards war and so on.
Especially during COVID and stuff like that, I imagine loads of these places, you know, shut down, like the hostels and certain places where homeless people would have, you know, like an outlet, almost somewhere to go and somewhere to stay. And obviously, during COVID, it's that messed up a lot of things, I'd imagine.
Less jobs, you know, economy maybe. Well, partially it's due to the pandemic, obviously, with people losing their jobs and whatnot. Rising inflation, all of these things take a part into it as well.
I feel as though freer liberal markets in Britain, and us having the paradigm of neoliberalism is squeezing the amount of spending that governments can focus on it. Things like economic crises become broader issues, which are taken more of a priority.
I think housing probably. A lot to do with housing. There's a lot of people coming into the country as well, which is also probably contributing to not enough beds, not enough spaces. You know,
there are not accurate policies in place to make sure that everyone is taken care of appropriately.
Well, myself, I'm self-employed, and I felt a big difference, yeah, to be honest. You know, before COVID and now, it's much difficult to get clients and, you know, make more money.
As long as I know, COVID, during the COVID lockdown and things, you know, they did increase that, you know, that accommodation, so people were, I mean, you know, given the accommodation, but definitely financially, mentally and physically, people are suffering a lot, actually, yes.
Here's the size of the problem. 11,580 single households were assessed as sleeping rough when asked. That's an increase of 39.4% compared to 2019-20. Families involving black ethnicity are disproportionately homeless. They account for 9.7% of those officially seen as needing support, but they only make up 3.5% of the population. Overall, in 2019-20, over 258,000 received homelessness assistance, a huge number for one of the world's most wealthy countries. How do people here in the city feel about the fact that a first world country such as Britain still has so many individuals living in a housing crisis or even sleeping rough?
Well, most of them is drugs, alcoholics, and for this reason they don't want to get into flat, because if the government give them a flat, they can't pay the rent. They can't pay the rent, they can't keep the flat maintained. So how can the government will help them out?
I was thinking that Britain is one of the most wealthy countries in the world, But when I came here, I saw a lot of people in the cities. They were living in streets, and literally they were eating from the no garbage.
I think we're very selfish. We don't really care about people next door. I think we're losing the sense of community, and until we go back to this community, minded people, that we're not going to sort homelessness or any other issue, poverty or whatever, drugs or whatever.
I'm just surprised it's happening. The money is here. They could do it if they want to do it. This is how I feel about it.
We've been supported by three different countries, and we still can't provide for people to actually become stable. And I feel like that's upon our Prime Minister and other associates.
There's always a solution if you want to find it, I would say. If people say there's not a magic money tree, but I guess if you really wanted to find the money, then you probably could somewhere. It's just where that money's going and where the government wants to prioritise.
Well, like Indira Gandhi said once, do you know what she said? I'll move from Bombay all the poor, so there will be no poor in India, Bombay. And Mr. Boris Johnson will do the same. Move all the poor from London and it will be rich London.
I feel like we're not doing enough. I feel like we're focused on the wrong things, you know what I mean? On the news every morning, it's this and that. You know, there's always another problem, and majority of the time it's about COVID or... I just feel like there's so many problems at the moment that...
In life, you usually just focus on yourself. But, you know, it's also nice to think about other people, but... You see, the people up there, the Prime Minister and stuff, they only think about themselves.
When you're dealing with things like homelessness, just giving them money isn't going to fix the issue. They need to learn what to do with the money, how to make the money stretch for them forever, you know, what to do with investing, pensions, getting jobs, things like that.
Governments are disassociated from people in Britain, and the other issues have become a higher priority, such as sort of economic sustainability and international competitiveness of Britain, rather than there's just no sort of community spirit voting for Labour movements and left-wing movements. There's no collective action anymore.
It is really frustrating. It is really frustrating, and it is really the hamper of the British people's.
And I do know that, you know, society is complaining, people's complaining.
When I'm walking and if I see it, I feel so bad. I mean, you know, I'm lucky enough to have, a shelter on my, head. But when you see the, you know, it's the first world country, developed country, there's no shortage of money. But sadly, those people are sleeping rough, not looked after.
What is the future for the United Kingdom when the streets of its capital have become home for over 10,000 people?
We know this, like, rich people are getting richer, poor people are getting poorer, which obviously is going to lead to more people being homeless. And the housing in London especially is ridiculous, it's so expensive. How many people can actually afford, you know, to buy a house, to rent a decent place that they can go home? Not many people.
Well, I don't see where we're going. Hopefully I'll be standing and be able to demonstrate about it with no violence. You know, I talk about it. That's all you need to do, you know. Just show the government that this should not happen. You know, people should not sleep outside, especially in this cold weather.
One thing is, I'm also not blaming only nation, because some people can work and they should work. And those who cannot, they should get help.
To be honest, I think it'll only get worse. I don't think, hopefully, because like you say, we do have the resources to help these people, you know what I mean? And, you know, they're all, especially at the moment, like you said, I don't know what the number was, but 10,000, you know, people going to sleep, especially, like I said, during winter, it's freezing.
Well, it's either going to increase or it's going to go lower until the Prime Minister does something. And he's not doing much right now.
Although homelessness has gotten worse over the first few years, look back 30, 40 years, maybe even more, it has gotten much better since then. Unemployment has gone down loads and loads. So it is getting better. Like I said, because of how complex it is, it's going to take many, many years.
The future is just to get worse, currently. if it continues down this road, then there'll be no momentum or motivation to change anything unless something fundamental changes within the parliamentarian system.
I think there's a lot more than 10,000, to be honest with you. I don't think there is 10,000. I mean, you've only got to go up and down London and you see them on the trains, you see them on the roads.
Unless we have a change in the government, I cannot see anything positive. I think there is a need for a government who would be sympathetic, who would understand the actual issues. If you are living in a mansion, I am not too sure how would you understand the difficulties and issues people facing on the street.
I think it's going to be even more, to be honest. If nothing's going to change, it's going to get worse. Yeah, because the young generation's growing as well. They're struggling to get jobs. They're struggling to get a property or to afford to rent. It's going to get worse, yeah.
Well, it's not sending a good image, if you ask me, but I think the whole world is the same, really. It's not just Britain. But I think it's going to get better. Let's just hope it gets better.
I think I had my time. Perhaps the next generation is going to be getting even tougher time. So, in one hand, government is borrowing billions and hundreds of billions of pounds. Nobody knows where it's going. But the next generation has to pay. And perhaps, sadly, the homeless people will be the last one to be in the queue to get the help.
Mr. John Sparks, the chief executive of homeless charity Crisis, has said, "You cannot free people from the cycle of homelessness without a proper home and, crucially, the support they need to keep it long-term." Amnesty International adds that frontline services warn they are at breaking point due to a rise in homelessness and that the UK could be facing a human rights catastrophe. At the same time, when it comes to housing difficulties, black households are particularly at risk.
As the UK experiences yet another rise in COVID-19, and as Boris Johnson appears focused on his own survival, his government struggles to solve the homelessness issue. The Prime Minister could himself be evicted from Downing Street. Yet his problems are small compared to being homeless or sleeping rough day after day. But the government's COVID crisis has made it even less able to help one of the most vulnerable groups in the country, people with nowhere to live.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
for humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته and welcome to IRIB English Radio and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights and specifically justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi al-salam. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when He made it a law that me and you need to pay our alms and our taxes, where it is khums or zakah, where it is the fifth of our earnings or paying taxes if we have sheep and cattle and grow crops, the taxes and these alms, they go to a place as we call Baytul Mal, or the treasury today. The treasury's job is to collect the taxes of people and divide it amongst those who are destitute and those who are poor and those who are less off. That's the job of Baytul Mal. At the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Salamullahi alayhi, and the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa even before him and all the other imams, that Baytul Mal, the Islamic treasury, continued and it was supposed to give to the poor. However, before the Imam alayhi salam, I mean during the Prophet's time, we have no issue, everyone was getting his right done correctly because the Prophet was there. After the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa the Baytul Mal turned into a personal bank for certain people. Whether the Khalifa, he would give only the people that he wants, the people that he likes, and he divided amongst his family members and relatives, until it led, if we look at the books of history, we can see that with the third Khalifa, you know, the people had enough, they had to raid his house, and as a process of this unfair distribution of the treasure of the Muslims, he was killed. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, when he talks to his companion and commander Malik al-Ashtar in the famous letter, he says to him that when it comes to Baytul Mal, you have to divide it equally amongst people. So he says, assign for their uplift a portion of the state's Baytul Mal's wealth. Wherever they may be, whether close at hand or far from you. Now, I don't know if it's just me, but Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi's word, are so precise that sometimes it gives you goosebumps. That when he talks about distributing Baytul Mal, especially with countries, if you look at the systems today, sometimes the country or the government will assign a portion of wealth to a specific city. So the major cities, they will get a big portion when it comes to their infrastructure and when it comes to, you know, doing things within the city. But there are small towns, because they are further away, and small villages, because they are far away, they get neglected and services don't even come to them. Okay? So this happens even today in the most civilized countries that we have. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, back, you know, over 1400 years ago, he's saying to Malik, when you want to divide, you have to be absolutely equal to those who are close and those who are far, which means they all have to be present in your mind constantly. Now, before we continue this notion, and let us take a short break and then we will continue.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Just before the break, we were saying that Amir al-Mu'mineen was telling his companion and his commander, Malik al-Ashtar, that he needs to divide a portion of the treasury, the Muslim treasury, to the poor, regardless of where they might be, close or far. And then he says to him, the rights of the two should be equal in your eye. Now, whether we take the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen literally, close and far, in terms of distance, he says they should be equal. So someone who lives in my city should treat them equally to those who live 1,000 kilometers from my city. Because at the end of the day, they are under my system. If we take it the literal word of close and far. And sometimes, no, in terms of relation, well, it's human nature that we'd like to, you know, favor our own kind and our own family, our own kin. So I says to him, if you want to give, you have to treat everyone the same. Because he's your brother, because he's your cousin, because he's your relative, it does not mean that you give him less than those who are not related to you. They all should be treated the same. This is something that he himself applied when people were coming to him without mentioning the names. They said to him, "Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, we want our wealth, our share from the treasury," and he used to give them. And then they started complaining. They said to him, "Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, how is it fair that you, I am the Arab, I am from Quraysh, from the tribe of Quraysh, the honored tribe of Quraysh, you are giving me the same as those who are foreigners or who are, you know, Persians back in the day. Why are you equaling between us?" And Amir al-Mu'mineen said, simple. Last time I checked, I found out that the sons of man all came from Adam and Adam came from the dust. I didn't see any difference between them. So why should I differentiate between an Arab and a non-Arab? There should not be any distinction between the two. They should be treated the same. So Amir al-Mu'mineen is trying to bring that to mind. Even when his brother Aqil came to Amir al-Mu'mineen asking for extra help from the treasure of the Muslims, and as we know, Aqil was a blind man, he said to him, he took an iron rod and he heated up that iron rod, and then he said to his brother Aqil, "Touch it. Take it." And when Aqil touched the iron, obviously it burnt him, and Aqil started crying and screaming. He says to him, "You are crying from a heat of a rod, an iron rod that a man has heated up for his play, and you expect me to live and, you know, be in a fire that the Lord has ignited it for his anger? I don't care if you're my brother or not. At the end of the day, everyone need to be treated the same. Everyone needed to be treated equal." So he says to Malik, if you want to distribute portion of the money of the treasure to the people, make sure in terms of distance or in terms of relation, everyone is treated equal. And then he says to him, do not treat their interests as of less importance than your own, which is also quite fair in terms of human rights. You know, why should you think they are more important and your matters are more important than other people? Everyone should be treated the same. This is just, I am simplifying the human rights in the perspective and in the ideology and in the sight of the commander of the faithful. Inshallah, we will continue looking at more of Amir al-Mu'mineen's human rights in other episodes. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. اللهم صل على محمد وآله. و
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.